It's Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the House Committee investigating the January 6th, 2021 insurrection is going to hold public hearings starting in June. We'll talk about some of the latest developments, from Mark Meadows' text messages to Kevin McCarthy phone call recordings. First, it's the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Member Drive. Larry Mueller is with me now. You count on the Ideas Network for interesting conversations that keep you in touch with Wisconsin and the world. We count on you to help keep these discussions on the air.
Listener support's the largest piece of the funding that makes this show and all the others that you enjoy possible, and that's why your gift at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552 is so important.
Last hour, we heard from 7 people. We are looking for 10 gifts this hour. Thanks if you've given so far this drive. If not, help us hit these goals. They help make sure that Wisconsin Public Radio has the money to pay for the programs you rely on.
So let's meet this goal. It happens one gift at a time. Let's start with yours at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Public Radio has this unique funding model. It's a two-way street that creates a high-quality product. Here's how it works. You voluntarily contribute. In turn, you get back programs that are accountable to you.
It's an amazing system. You get programs worth listening to precisely because you step up and support them. So make your contribution for independent news, for information and music right now. Help pay for all the programs you enjoy on WPR. Just go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552.
Here's a special Arbor Day celebration. We're partnering with Alliant Energy today to help preserve Wisconsin's natural landscapes. When you make a gift of any amount, 10 trees will be planted throughout the state. Your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Helps public radio, helps the trees.
It really does. And on Wisconsin Public Radio, you get access to the whole world, including those trees. We talk about trees once in a while. And we really do. That really makes a difference in your life. You get the news and information you need to stay informed and conversations that make you think, along with some great music and entertainment that help you relax.
Yeah, the trees never call into Central Time, Larry.
No.
They call into your show, though, right, on Garden Talk.
We're barking up the wrong tree here.
All right. Let's not go down that road, Larry. No matter where you are, when you listen to WPR, you are participating in a statewide and in some ways a worldwide community, hearing from artists or reporters or experts because you appreciate the connection to the wider world. Make your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It's really your radio station, the one that makes you wakes you up in the morning. It rides with you on your commute, keeps you company during the day.
And the beauty of WPR is that you get to decide how much to pay for the programs you enjoy. A lot of first-time donors will give, say, $100, or maybe they'll do $10 a month. The thing is, though, you get to pick the amount that's right for you.
And your gift, along with donations from other listeners, add up to WPR's largest source of funding. So join the team right now. Make your gift at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Again, looking to hit our goal of 10 gifts this hour. You can help us get there when you give right now. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. End the week on a high note, knowing that you helped ensure a great future for the programs you count on.
Happy Arbor Day to everyone. Today, WPR is partnering with Alliant Energy to celebrate and preserve Wisconsin's natural landscape. And when you support Wisconsin Public Radio by going to WPR.org or by phoning 888-202-2552, 10 trees will be planted in the state. So thank you for supporting the programs you rely on and for celebrating Arbor Day with us.
Now is a great time to become a sustaining member. It's easy to set up convenient, ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or your credit card. Get it started now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And, you know, we heard from Arlene in Stoughton. I was born in Stoughton, Arlene, and I want to say thank you for your comments. And what are those comments? Well, she says, WPR has gotten me through some very difficult times. And thank you. Joseph from Madison says, I've been a listener and a supporter for years. It's a habit I don't want to break.
Thank you so much, Joseph. Thank you, Arlene. How about you? Do you count on Wisconsin Public Radio for news, for great conversations, for companionship. That is lovely. I'm glad you do. We also count on you to help pay for it all. You can do that right now with your gift of any amount online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552, and thank you. This is Central Time. We're getting a clearer picture now of the timeline for the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. The committee's chair, Democratic Representative Benny Thompson from Mississippi, told reporters yesterday there will be as many as 8 hearings starting on June 9th. And this comes as a lot of new information has come up in the last week on efforts to overturn the results of the November 2020 election, including a lot of texts between then-Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and members of Congress and others, plus recordings of Republican leaders critical of Donald Trump behind the scenes, less so in public. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you following the work of this House committee looking at the effort to overturn the election? What do you think of the investigation so far? Do you want it to keep going? Are you learning more about it, or do you think it's time to wrap it up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Ginger Gibson is Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital. Ginger, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
Before we get into specifics, Ginger, I mean, it seems like there's like this steady trickle over the last week or two. We've learned a lot, haven't we?
We have. There's been some new leaks that have come out. CNN obtained more than 2,000 text messages that were sent between former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and various people, Republican lawmakers, aides to the former president, supporters of the former president, that revealed a little bit more about what was going on behind the scenes. I mean, we knew publicly that the president was pushing to have his defeat overturned, but now we understood the level of which his staff and his allies were going, the number of conspiracy theories that they were pushing, and the conversations they were having about sort of these half-baked legal theories or these online conspiracy theories that they thought might deliver him the chance to overturn his defeat.
Now, some of that information is coming from texts involving President Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, from the period just after the election up to Inauguration Day. Who were some of the people Meadows was in contact with, and what stands out to you about what we read there?
Yeah, we saw a number of messages between him and lawmakers, particularly talking with folks like Mike Lee, the senator from Utah, about what type of messaging lawmakers should be using, their strategy to object to the election on January 6th, how they were working together. I think that there was, based on some of those messages with Lee and with other Republican House members, a desire for them to give them some direction, to talk to them about how they needed to be making the argument to put together a cohesive strategy for objecting on January 6th. And then we saw messages from folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was pushing the chief of staff to be more aggressive in their efforts. And then from folks like Mike Lindell, you know, the MyPillow guy, who was asking for more information. We saw messages from Jason Miller, who was a political aide to the president, asking Mark Meadows to give the president some information from some conspiracy theories he was interested in. So it's really sort of a multifaceted front. And I want to be clear, we haven't validated these ourselves. So, you know, a handful of them we have, but what are these messages? Where did they come from? We're not entirely sure independently on our own.
One that's gotten a lot of attention is one you mentioned, a member of Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. On January, I believe it was 17th, so 11 days after what happened on January 6th, texting saying, yeah, some of us in Congress, some fellow congressional members are talking about the need for martial law in the next 3 days before Inauguration Day. That is pretty striking.
That's right. So this message from Marjorie Taylor Greene, in which she says in a private chat with only members, several are saying that the only way to save the Republic is for Trump to call for martial law. This is a message that was then pointed to and some efforts to have her removed from the ballot, as an effort has been done so in Georgia. Her lawyers told ABC News that they were authorized to say, or NBC News telling us, they were authorized to say she has no recollection of this text message. She doesn't remember sending it, and her text messages are deleted after 30 days. So she doesn't even have it left on her phone. So this is one of the ones that has drawn a lot of attention, I think, because the idea that they would have declared martial law after January 6th in an effort to continue to keep the president from being removed from office after he lost is really kind of alarming.
We're talking to Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor, NBC News Digital. We're talking about developments in the story of the House Select Committee investigating January 6th, including a release of text messages from former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, reference from, as we just heard, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, that the president should institute martial law. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this ongoing investigation? What's been learned? What do you want to see happen? Do you want to see charges recommended by this House committee? If so, do you want to see the Justice Department pursue charges? If so, against who? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk on some of the latest storylines around the January 6th, 2021 insurrection at the Capitol, the House Select Committee investigating it. Ginger Gibson stays with us, Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Ginger, the New York Times reporting heavily over the last week about House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy. It's tied to a new book by a pair of their reporters. McCarthy pushed back in the reporting. The Times shared several clips of McCarthy speaking on phone calls with other House leaders. Here's an example from a January 10th phone call the Times said with McCarthy and other congressional Republican leaders.
The only discussion I would have with him is that I think this will pass, and it would be my recommendation we should move on. That would be my take, but I don't think he would take it, but I don't know.
The pronoun there, the him is then President Donald Trump. Ginger, people have made a lot of some of these recordings as a contrast between what McCarthy and other Republican leaders were saying behind the scenes and what they were saying in public. What are you seeing here?
Yeah, and we really watched the Republican Party and its leaders make a real shift from the hours and days after January 6th to the weeks and months. In the days after, Kevin McCarthy was very critical of Trump. We now know that he was privately saying, as those recordings reveal, that he thought Trump should resign. Now, he didn't, to be clear, say he thinks Trump should resign because what he did was terrible, although he does call it inexcusable and that he should be held accountable. He's saying he should resign because he's going to be removed by Congress, that the votes are there to impeach and remove him, and that would be a bad precedent. So he should resign beforehand, like Nixon did when it became clear he was going to be removed. But ultimately, that didn't happen. You know, Congress did not act quickly enough to hold a Senate trial before Trump left office anyway. You know, there was 2 weeks between the January 6th riot and Inauguration Day. And by the time they did get around to holding that trial in February, later in the month, in the middle of the month, the votes were no longer there to convict the former president. So I think we saw a shift, and this really illustrates that behind the scenes, what those of us the sense those of us in Washington had, which was that in the immediate aftermath, there was a lot of displeasure among Republicans, sort of faded. And as we've seen in the year and months since then, a real move back to defending the former president, to trying to win his good graces, to be seen as aligned with him, from folks like McCarthy, who at the time, as that recording shows, thought he should have resigned.
We got a caller. Severance is with us in West Allis. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I was listening to the radio and I was listening to the House Select Committee trying to make a decision about pursuing charges on Trump, and I believe they need to.
All right. That's a big issue there, Ginger. The committee itself, I don't think, can file charges, but a big question is, will they recommend charges? And if they do, who would pick those up and run with them?
That's right. So the committee can't charge anyone. They don't have prosecutorial power, but they do have the ability to recommend to the Department of Justice, to the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, that he seek some charges. And there has been some debate within the committee about whether or not they should make that recommendation. They really wanted to see Merrick Garland pursue charges, but I think it's become increasingly apparent to them, to other lawmakers, that that's just not going to happen. It would be very difficult for the DOJ to press charges based on the way the law is written. And it would be quite a political issue. And I think some who argue against it say there was a political process that exists to hold a president accountable for something like January 6th, and that's impeachment. And as we just said, they've lost the will to do that in the weeks after the January 6th riot.
Thanks for that call. What are you watching for next, Ginger, including this series of planned, I believe, public hearings?
Yes. So in June, the committee is going to start holding hearings. The big question most of us here who follow this closely have is whether all of the good, interesting stuff, you know, the juicy stuff, has already been leaked, or if there are some more surprises and revelations to come. We understand that the committee is going to hold 9 hearings, some of them during prime time. They really have said they want this to be a blockbuster. They want it to tell us story from start to finish about what happened. And they're starting to say they think that there are still some things that can get the public's attention. But there's a real question about whether they've lost sort of the most riveting details to leak so far, or if they're going to be able to really make a compelling case. As we said, we still don't think it's likely that this will result in criminal charges. An impeachment process is over. Really, all of this is targeted at the public, convincing the public that what Trump did and his role that day and in the days leading up to it were wrong, and trying to sort of convince them in the court of public opinion to convict the former president for his role in the attack.
And Ginger, how much do you get the sense that this is focused on January 6th itself versus the whole effort to overturn the election? Because leading up to January 6th, the big shocking information is the recording of the president of the United States pleading and begging with the Secretary of State of Georgia to find him X number of votes.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a lot of revelations from the day of the election in November until the day he left office on the 20th, that all of these things, that January 6th was sort of the flashpoint, but that they all led into that and then didn't stop that day. We're going to be hearing about things that were happening in November and December, maybe even into February after the president left office. And this is because they believe that they were contributing. One of the things we know that they've investigated on the panel is who was paying for things leading up to January 6th? Who paid for all of these people to fly to Washington? Were they all coming out of their own pockets or not? What was Trump doing not only in the Oval Office that day, but in the day before and the day after? So we'll not be contained to just that one day. We'll be really a broader look at the events leading up to it.
Ginger, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital, with us today to talk about a big couple of weeks in the news with info about January 6th and the investigation and what happened into what happened before, during, and after that day. Now it's the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Member Drive. Larry Mueller hops in with me now. The largest source of funding for WPR programs is from listeners like you. And this drive is your chance to support all the programs you listen to throughout the year. Take the important step when you donate at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
About 34 minutes left in the hour, and we're looking for 6 more people, Rob, to join in. And as you listen, I hope you'll think about a gift. Your gift right now is so important because when you give, you support the programs you rely on every day.
Thanks so much if you've already given. If you haven't, the time is now. Give at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
Really enjoyed that last segment with Ginger Gibson as we talked about the January 6th and the insurrection. I think this is the kind of interesting, important, informative, substantive information you're going to find on Wisconsin Public Radio. These are the kind of conversations you can count on from Central Time.
WPR is listener supported. That means your donation at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes the many topics you tune in for every day possible. Choose an amount that works for you and then make your gift.
Our monthly giving program is becoming more and more popular. In fact, we have more than 25,000 sustainers who make ongoing monthly gifts. And that number is growing day by day.
Give it a try. We think you'll like it. We hear from a lot of people who love being a sustainer. I'm a sustainer. Larry, you're a sustainer. You've mentioned that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You like it, right?
Oh, it's good. It's the easy way to do it.
I like it too. Because I, you know, maybe you're like me. You're like, I gave like what, 3-7 years ago? But that's me. You're probably smarter than I am. But being a sustainer means that's one thing off of my mental clock, right? One thing I don't have to focus on. I know I'm giving because I'm a sustainer. You can do it too. It's easy with a gift of $10 or $20 a month or whatever amount works for you right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Really helps us ensure a kind of a steady flow of dollars coming in every single month. Wisconsin Public Radio, hey, it's a powerful source for news, talk, and music that we've all created together. This service has an impact all over the state and far beyond, too. It provides great information. It provides a connection across the state with our public. And I think it often provides some inspiration.
And your support really does help enrich the lives of hundreds of thousands of listeners. Make your impact. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And maybe giving a dollar a day is the right amount for your Wisconsin Public Radio listening. When you think about it, a dollar a day, it's a great value. It's less than a cup of coffee or a soft drink or a day of cell phone service, for that matter.
Dollar a day comes out to $30 a month. You could set that up as a monthly transfer from your bank account or charge to your credit card. Make your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Still six. Let's see. What have we got left? 30 minutes left in the hour. We're looking for six.
Four more now, actually. I just got to know. Four more. Oh. We're making our way there, Larry.
All right. Well, good. Four more. Maybe you could be one of those four. Make your gift today at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. It will ensure a bright future for the programs you rely on.
Weird from Ellen in Madison. Ellen says, I listen to WPR all day. I love Larry Mueller and Central Time. I learn so much every day, Ellen says. Thank you so much. Thanks for spending your 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. with us. Really do appreciate it. Glad to spend this time with you, Ellen, and thank you so much for giving. How about you? Make your gift right now, online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552, and thank you. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, this is an interesting piece of American history. The federal government hired out-of-work writers in the 1930s to create state travel guides. We'll look at what made it into those books and what they can teach us about America during the Great Depression. Now it's the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Member Drive. Larry Mueller is with me. You count on the Ideas Network for great discussions. It's your gift of any amount that makes it all possible. Listener support is the largest source of funding for WPR programs. That is why your support is so important right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we have about 24 minutes left in this hour and looking for only three more people to join in. When you give, you fund Central Time and all the other WPR programs you count on. So give right now at WPR.org. Or at 888-202-2552.
You know, the world, the internet, it's full of headlines and sound bites and quick hits on topics. Where do you go, though, for an in-depth discussion?
To the Ideas Network, of course.
I hope so.
I hope so, too. Here you just don't get a 20-second clip or a few minutes of back and forth. You get plenty of time to develop ideas and ask questions. WPR is a great source of in-depth information, and your support right now makes it all possible at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Hoping you give and hoping you make a gift that works for you. For you, that might be a gift of $100 or $200 a month.
Maybe that's about what you pay for cable or your family phone plan. Listening to WPR is something you do every day, so put a value on it like other things that are important to you at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Today is Arbor Day, and we're celebrating with an exciting opportunity for you to support the WPR programs you love and to protect Wisconsin's forests. When you make a donation of any amount, Alliant Energy will plant 10 trees throughout the state. This is your chance to make an even greater impact. Today only, power the essential news and quality entertainment you rely on and help preserve Wisconsin's forests. When you give now, here's how.
Make that gift. Get those trees planted at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. It's Central Time. Rob Ferret here with Larry Mueller. Your support during this spring member drive makes the WPR programs you rely on possible. Your gift of $10 or $20 a month, whatever amount you choose, is the right amount to give.
And we know you value your time, and we value your time as well. So giving to Wisconsin Public Radio takes just a couple of minutes. Tell us your name, contact information, how much you want to give, and how you'd like to pay.
Quick, it's easy. Your gift right now really does help. Take the next few minutes to support the station you count on at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
$10 a month contribution to Wisconsin Public Radio works out to just, it's 33 cents a day. That's a pretty good value.
You get
if you
a
ask
lot.
Me.
You get a lot for 33 cents a day. Make that gift of $10 a month or more right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. You get a lot in return.
We got about 20 minutes left in the program. Is looking for 3 more contributions this hour. Maybe you could be one of those 3. Your gift today at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. It ensures a bright future for the programs you rely on.
Here's the deal. We got a heavy hitter here on Central Time with you. We got the Larry Mueller with me. We want to look good. We want to hit. We want to exceed the goal. And let me tell you, if we don't hit it, Larry's going to yell at me. He's really mean. No, I'm just kidding. Larry's awesome. But he's going to feel great if we hit our goal, if we exceed our goal. I'll feel great. But the important thing is, you're going to feel great, too, when you give, knowing that you're supporting the radio you count on. Make your gift right now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
And right now is a great time to become a sustaining member. It's so easy to do. You can set up convenient, ongoing monthly donations from your bank account. A lot of people use their credit card for that. Get started at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
We heard from Donald in Dodgeville, who says, I like to think that listening to WPR is a permanent benefit for living in Wisconsin. Donald, thanks so much. And it is a benefit thanks to you and all the people like you who have given over the years. Join Donald now with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The New Deal created a wide range of job programs to put Americans back to work during the Great Depression, including out-of-work writers. Some of those authors working under the Federal Writers Project were tasked with putting together travel guides for every state in the Union, as well as many cities. When the American Guide series started to get published in the late 1930s, it was clear the books were more than just sightseeing checklists. They dug into social history, personal stories, and created a time capsule of American society at one of the country's toughest points. Scott Borchert is author of the book Republic of Detours, How the New Deal Paid Broke Writers to Rediscover America. Here's a listen to our conversation. You've read through a lot of these guides, and they're a unique artifact. It doesn't sound like your usual rah-rah travel guide. They're kind of literature. They're history.
Right.
Tell us what we find when we crack the cover.
Sure. So I have here actually a copy of the Wisconsin Guide, and this book itself is 651 pages long. So these are pretty hefty, hardcover books. If you open one up, they have a uniform structure. So this is true of all of the state guidebooks. But if you open them up, it starts out with a section of essays. And these are essays on, history, industry, folklore, all kinds of things. Some of them are unique to the state. Like in Wisconsin, there's an essay on the cooperative movement. So it's not necessarily something that, if you were just traveling down the road, you felt like you needed to learn about. But if you did want to learn about that, it's all right in there. And then next in the guidebook, there's a section of profiles of major cities. It's kind of tell you what's there, the history of the city and that sort of thing. And then the really interesting stuff comes at the end. The last third of all these guidebooks are the tour sections. And this seems very straightforward. It just says, you start in one spot, get in your car, drive to the next spot. It'll tell you what you see along the way. But these tours are just jam-packed with all sorts of weird, obscure history and local lore, you know, unusual characters, myths and legends, and stories that may be true or may not be true. Yeah, it's the kind of thing, you know, if you're driving in your car, it might not be very helpful if you're trying to find a restaurant or just a place to pull over, but it's totally fascinating if you're just traveling to a new area and you want to hear what it's all about, or if you're just sitting at home and reading about a place that you'd like to visit someday.
And these books were published for a few years, went off the market, became collector's items, and Scott, you ended up with a treasure trove. How did that happen?
Yeah, that's right. So I had a great uncle who was kind of an eccentric book collector. He started collecting these guidebooks, you know, soon after they were published in the 1940s when he was still kind of a young man. And he spent the rest of his life collecting them and all the other publications that were created by the Federal Writers Project. There are about 1,000, it's estimated, that were created during the life of the project before it was dissolved in 1943. And when my great uncle died, this is in 2005, he had about almost 400 of them. So he had a pretty big collection. And most of them were sold off to other book collectors who were looking for these kind of things. They're pretty rare. But the core set of state guidebooks ended up with me, and I had these sitting around for a while and was just so fascinated by them. You know, every time I would open one and find something really interesting or surprising. And then I started to actually research what the project was all about, how it was started, you know, as part of this New Deal program of creating jobs for people during the Depression, and I just became totally, you know, smitten with it.
Now, it's a complicated story in some ways. You go into some detail about it, but give us the basics. How did the New Deal end up scrambling to recruit writers all over the country to tell these stories?
Yeah, sure. So early on in the Roosevelt administration, you know, they were providing relief to people directly, like in the form of cash payments, usually, or other things, just to meet, you know, the crisis of the Depression. And pretty soon they decided that what would be better would be to give people jobs, because then people could still work, they could still conserve the skills that they had, and they could contribute something useful to society. There are all these projects that needed to get done and weren't happening. And so they created, there are a few other, you know, relief agencies before this, but the Works Progress Administration in 1935 was the big one. And most of the work that the WPA did had to do with building like physical infrastructure like roads and sewers and airports and that sort of thing. But they decided that they wanted to expand it into other areas and also create jobs for cultural workers. So they had this thing called Federal Project Number One, and there were projects for writers, for artists, musicians, and for theater people. And, you know, the idea was that these are all people who needed work, you know, like everyone else during the Depression, they were really desperate. They needed something just to keep them alive. But they had these special skills that they'd used for possibly a whole career. And the government didn't want to see those, you know, be destroyed during the Depression. And they thought that they could get some really unique and valuable work out of them if they put them to these different, you know, cultural tasks.
We're talking to Scott Borchert about his book, Republic of Detours, How the New Deal Paid Broke Writers to Rediscover America. Looking at the Federal Writers Project and the unique books that came out of it. And Scott, you write that, you know, for a lot of writers coming into this time, the cool thing to do was to go to Europe and write about Europe. And this project ended up being part of this movement to look inward and really discover, and as you say in your subtitle, rediscover America. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right, yeah. For a long time, you know, in the first decades of the 20th century, for a lot of writers and other kinds of artists, Europe was kind of the standard, and everyone was fixated on Europe and, you know, classical antiquity. And the idea was that the United States didn't really have the same kind of depth of culture. There wasn't as much going on here. It wasn't as sophisticated or something to emulate. But that all started to change for a lot of different reasons. It was kind of a broader cultural trend, this renewed interest in American history and cultural heritage. It was all kind of going on those first couple of decades. But then with the Depression, it just sort of, I think, sent everyone into this you know, new phase of wondering, like, you know, we need new answers to the questions that are out there. The old answers aren't working. The whole kind of like assumptions we have about our society and the government, the economic order and everything like that are kind of crumbling in front of our eyes. So the best thing to do is to go back and look at the past, look at, you know, the textures of American culture and see if there are new answers there that we can find. So for a lot of different reasons, you had writers kind of returning to, you know, their home territory and taking a really close look at it and trying to see if they could use it for their fiction or poetry or to write new forms of journalism or take, you know, like photo essays and cover what their fellow citizens were doing and what they're going through during the Depression.
There's a lot of writers involved in this. And as you see in the book, some famous, some less so, some very talented, some less so. What kind of tones do we get out of this as all these different authors are going to all these different places?
Yeah, it's really funny because if you go back and look in the archival material, I mean, there's mountains and mountains of stuff in the National Archives and the Library of Congress. And a lot of it's online today, too, so people can access it and check it out, and they really should. It's really interesting. But you can see some of this original material that writers who go on to great things later were writing at the time, like Richard Wright, Margaret Walker's also in Chicago with Richard Wright at first. Richard Wright went to New York City, and there are a bunch of other great writers there. John Cheever was working on the New York City guidebook for a little bit. But a lot of this stuff all kind of got evened out to a certain extent during the process of creating these books, because it really was a collective process from the very bottom to the top. So you'd have writers, you know, in every state across the country going out to their communities, surveying what they found, writing up little profiles of, you know, local people, stories, history, what kind of factories there were in the area, what kind of crops they grew, like basically everything. That would all get fed back into the state offices. They'd work on it, create a manuscript, send it to Washington. They'd work on it there. There's a lot of back and forth. So by the time you got a finished manuscript, you had something that probably, you know, 10, 20 people had been involved in terms of writing and editing and rewriting. So you can't always trace, you know, what an individual person was doing. But it is pretty remarkable because when you look at the guides, there is this voice to them. So you think sometimes you're reading just something written by a very interesting, quirky, sort of eccentric writer from the 30s, but you're actually looking at the product of, you know, many people.
What's it like to go back in, you know, 2021 and get this firsthand view of maybe our hometown or our home state in the midst of the Depression?
Yeah, it's really fascinating because the guidebooks were supposed to be, you know, they weren't necessarily a snapshot of the Depression. They're supposed to be, you know, the whole history of a place up to that point. So there's a lot going back, you know, the last two centuries or whatever. But it's inevitable that so much from the Depression comes into it. So you'll see in a tour, it'll be talking about, you know, some historical tavern where something, you know, notable happened in 1850 or whatever. And then it'll say right around the corner, there's a, you know, Civilian Conservation Corps camp, and these people had just started going out there and clearing trails or something like that. So you can kind of see the active, you know, measures that the Roosevelt administration was taking at the time woven in through these guides. This is really fascinating. But then there are also little reminders of just the hardship that people were going through at the time. And just the kind of devastation that the Depression was, you know, having across the country in all different ways, from, you know, farms, you know, going under during the Dust Bowl, to just cities where all these, you know, relief agencies were popping up and that sort of thing. Like, you know, it's completely inevitable that you see that in the guides.
We had this unprecedented investment in writers as well as artists and others from the federal government in these relief programs. There was a brief moment, Scott, where there was talk and an effort in Congress to make it a permanent thing. That is not the road we traveled. Why did this end?
Yeah, so this was a very popular program for a while for a lot of people, but there were always the critics from the beginning who were opposed to the idea of the federal government getting into any kind of, well, for the first part, getting into any kind of direct employment of people. A lot of people were opposed to that just in principle, but also getting into the cultural industry. And they thought it was ridiculous that the government was hiring people to write guidebooks when they could ostensibly be doing more important things. But, you know, it was all part of this general plan to address the Depression and to find work for people. But some people were just never, some critics, I should say, would never be convinced that this was so. And the other thing was that they knew that a lot of people who were working for these cultural projects or part of the New Deal were political radicals, including people who were in the Communist Party or in the orbit of the Communist Party, which, you know, for the 1930s was not exceptional at all. You had millions of people who, you know, considered themselves on the left in some way, whether they were party members or not. It was kind of a cultural moment. So they all played active roles in these projects, as they were totally allowed to according to the law. But for a lot of people who were critical of the projects to begin with, this was sort of the ultimate sin, and they couldn't stand for it. So there was a committee that was formed in Congress by Martin Dies, who's a Democratic congressman from Texas. And this was the first iteration of the House Un-American Activities Committee. And they really focused, I mean, they investigated all kinds of things, but they really focused on the Federal Writers Project and the Federal Theater Project, because I think they thought these were kind of like the soft cultural underbelly of the New Deal. And so they could strike a blow against the entire New Deal program by targeting these projects, making it seem like they were overrun by radicals and communists, and you know, just complete waste of taxpayer dollars. So that's what happened. They investigated the project to kind of the story of the project really built to this crescendo with these hearings in late 1938. And then in 1939, Congress, you know, had been becoming increasingly hostile to certain parts of the New Deal and the Works Progress Administration specifically. And so they voted to get rid of the Federal Theater Project, and they kind of changed the structure of the Federal Writers Project, where it was no longer a sort of central national organization. It was kind of broken down to a state-by-state basis. The director, this guy, Henry Allsberg, who I write about in the book, who's just kind of this visionary and interesting, eccentric figure, he was fired from the project. And it just never quite recovered after that.
Scott, thanks a lot for sharing the story with us today.
Sure. No problem at all. Thanks.
That was author Scott Borchert. He joined us to talk about his book, Republic of Detours, How the New Deal Paid Broke Writers to Rediscover America. Now it's the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Member Drive. Larry Mueller is with me, and we are here now to raise the money that pays for the programs that you enjoy, programs like Central Time. Support from people like you is the largest piece of funding for the programs that you value. That's why your support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 is so important.
And here's another reason to contribute, because there are many people listening who can't afford to give, probably right in your own community. And so you'll be helping some of your neighbors as well. And that's something to be thankful for, I think, and excited about, too. So a good time to go would be right now to online, WPR.org, or phone 888-202-2552 and make your contribution.
In that last conversation, we heard about this fascinating part of American history that, I'll be honest, I knew nothing about until, I didn't either.
You know,
I read the guy's book. it was super interesting, this time capsule. And I was thinking, as I listen back to it now, because this is one we'd recorded, I want to get on my hands on that Wisconsin book. Why did I think of doing that? I mean, we could build features around that all the time.
Man.
And like compare and contrast what they wrote then to what's there now. I don't know. It's like, it'd be a good Larry Mueller project.
I would love that. I thought it was just an absolutely great interview. I had never heard of it before. That's one of the kind of cool things about Wisconsin Public Radio. And it's also, I think, why WPR is listener-supported, and being listener-supported is such a good idea. You find so many things that you know, you didn't know existed sometimes. And your donation at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552 makes the many topics you tune in for every day possible. So choose an amount for you and then make your gift.
Now, this is a time capsule from like 90 years ago or so. Yeah. You can help leave a time capsule, because in celebration of Arbor Day, we're partnering with Alliant Energy to plant trees in Wisconsin. So you'll support the news, the conversations, the music on Wisconsin Public Radio. And for your gift today, 10 trees are going to be planted to help preserve our natural landscapes. Join in with your gift right now of any amount at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I'm Sheree from Waupun. I will always care about the state of Wisconsin because of WPR. And that's a big thing for me to say. WPR has always been a positive experience. Even when it wasn't something that I necessarily wanted to hear, I always appreciate the opposite side, and I don't always understand the opposite side. I certainly don't always like it, but to hear it is important.
Make your contribution today, because listener support makes Wisconsin Public Radio possible. Give now at WPR.org and click donate.
Give at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. Central Time, Rob Ferret here with Larry Mueller. Great news. Found out we met our goal. We exceeded our goal. Let's keep that momentum going. Of course, there's some hours we fall short. Now we can catch up with those with your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And whether your contribution is $10 a month or $100 a month, we appreciate it and we count on your gift.
Make that contribution right now. You count on us for great conversations each and every day. We count on you to help pay for it. People like Todd in Princeton, who says, I appreciate community-oriented and supported programming. Thank you, Todd. I got to visit Princeton a couple years ago. A lovely visit. Love the flea market there. Big. That's a big flea market in Princeton, Larry.
I have never been to the flea market in Princeton. Here's another thing I've learned. I've learned a lot today during the show, and you're almost inspired me to give once again, which I often do. I just stick in extra donations from time to time. What about you? If you haven't given yet, join me, join Rob, join the thousands of other WPR listeners and members by donating. And just go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552.
Think about all the enjoyment you've gotten, all the information you've gotten from Wisconsin Public Radio here on Central Time, on the Larry Mueller Show, all your other favorite programs. Put a value on it and understand that we do because of you, because you listen, and we're able to do it because you give. Be a part of the team now with your gift in any amount online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. And thanks so much for your support. We really wouldn't be what we are without you.
It's just before 5 o'clock on the Ideas Network, and Central Time continues following your news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then stay with us after 6 for 1A Plus with Jen White from Washington, D.C., here on the Ideas Network.
On the Larry Mueller Show, we focus on how to make your life better every day, from practical advice to topics that affect communities across Wisconsin. We get to the bottom of your questions, from wildlife identification to why your car is making a strange noise to solving your tech dilemmas. Join me, Larry Mueller, on the Ideas Network, weekday mornings at 11, for talk that keeps you informed and learning throughout your day.